The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Dr. Scott Youngkin for the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is Health Issues. For the next half hour, I'll be reading articles from the Mayo Clinic Health Letter, the Harvard Heart Letter, and the Harvard Health Letter. And in fact, the first thing I'm going to read is from the Harvard Heart Letter, and is entitled, An Unexpected Benefit of Better Blood Pressure Control. New findings challenge the widespread belief that aggressive blood pressure treatment may trigger a condition linked to fainting and falls. When doctors treat older people with high blood pressure, they often worry about a condition that causes blood pressure to plummet when a person stands up from a seated or lying position. Known as orthostatic hypotension, hypotension means low blood pressure, it affects as many as 1 in 5 people aged 65 or older. Because orthostatic hypotension can make you feel dizzy or lightheaded after standing, it may lead to fainting and falls, with possibly serious repercussions. This concern leads some doctors to ease up on prescribed blood pressure medications. But a new study suggests that practice actually might do more harm than good. It may sound counterintuitive, but we found that people who received more intensive blood pressure treatment were actually less likely to have orthostatic hypotension than people who got less aggressive treatment, says study lead author Dr. Stephen Jurashek, an internist at Harvard-affiliated Beth Israel Deaconess Medical Center. Pressure drop. The study, published online September 10, 2020, by the Annals of Internal Medicine, pooled data from 5 separate trials that included more than 18,000 adults treated for high blood pressure. The researchers defined orthostatic hypotension as a decrease in systolic pressure, the first measure of blood pressure reading, of at least 20 points, or a decrease in diastolic pressure, the second number of at least 10 points, when measured within 3 minutes after standing up from a seated position. When people are diagnosed with orthostatic hypotension, especially if it causes dizziness, it's understandable for doctors to be tempted to reduce the person's blood pressure medication, Dr. Jurashek notes. However, other causes like dehydration or an infection actually may be to blame, especially among people who've been treated for blood pressure for a while. In addition, several diseases, including diabetes, cancer, and Parkinson's disease, can also contribute to orthostatic hypotension. Why better control may matter. Dr. Jurashek and colleagues speculate that intensive blood pressure control helps prevent orthostatic hypotension by keeping the entire cardiovascular system healthy and functioning well, particularly the baroreceptors, which help regulate blood pressure. For most people, an ideal blood pressure is less than 120 over 80 millimeters of mercury. Reaching and staying at that goal can help prevent the damaging effects of high blood pressure, which include stiff arteries and an enlarged weak left ventricle, the heart's main pumping chamber. Those problems can make orthostatic hypotension worse, says Dr. Jurashek. Coping with orthostatic hypotension. Feeling dizzy or lightheaded after standing happens to most people once in a while and is usually no cause for concern. But if it happens more frequently, ask your doctor to check you for orthostatic hypotension. If you started treatment recently for a high blood pressure diagnosis, you may feel lightheaded while your body adjusts to the medication, said Dr. Jurashek. But if you have orthostatic hypotension and have been taking blood pressure drugs for a while, Those medications might not be the problem, but rather part of the solution. To prevent episodes of low blood pressure, these strategies may help. Don't forget fluids. Drink water throughout the day. Don't wait until you're thirsty, but avoid alcohol, which can cause you to become dehydrated. Support your legs. Compression stockings that squeeze the legs may help. Thigh-high or waist-high versions are best because knee-high stockings may bunch and tighten and actually cut off blood flow. Take care when rising. Getting out of bed is a common trigger, so pump your legs up and down a few times while still sitting on the side of your bed to get your blood flowing before you stand up. During the day, try crossing your legs if you feel faint while standing. The next article also comes from the Harvard Heart Letter of January 2021 and is called Atrial Fibrillation: Shifting Strategies for Early Treatment. For people recently diagnosed, taming the heart's rhythm rather than slowing it down may be a better approach. The heart rhythm disorder known as atrial fibrillation occurs when the heart's electrical system goes awry. Instead of the heart's natural pacemaker creating a steady beat, the heart's upper chambers pulsate rapidly, up to hundreds of times per minute. Most of the electrical impulses telling the lower chambers to contract don't get through, but many do, triggering a racing, irregular heartbeat that can leave people feeling dizzy, breathless, or fatigued. Therapies to tackle this common arrhythmia have improved over the years. Now, new findings suggest it may be time to rethink the treatment for people newly diagnosed with AFib, which is a short way of saying atrial fibrillation. Bouts of atrial fibrillation may occur in brief episodes lasting hours to days, or continue for months or even years. The effect on people's lives also varies quite a bit. Some people are debilitated by symptoms after being in AFib for 5 minutes, says Dr. William Sauer, chief of the Cardiac Arrhythmia Service at Harvard-affiliated Brigham and Women's Hospital. Others don't even realize they have the condition until it's discovered by chance during routine checkup. Two main strategies can help tame AFib. One is known as rate control and involves taking medications to keep the heart rate in a normal range. The other, known as rhythm control, involves restoring the heart to its normal rhythm with a medication or a minimally invasive procedure. For decades, doctors have tended to start with rate control, mainly because the drugs used for rhythm control have more worrisome side effects. But the new study found that people who started with rhythm control rather than rate control soon after their diagnosis had fewer strokes and were less likely to die from heart disease. The findings were a bit surprising, said Dr. Sauer, but they probably reflect the fact that doctors are getting better at using rhythm control strategies. Historically, doctors haven't prescribed antiarrhythmic drugs unless a person had frequent, bothersome symptoms. The drugs are safe, but people taking them need to be closely monitored because of possible toxic effects on the liver, lungs, and thyroid, said Dr. Sauer. Rarely, rhythm control drugs trigger a potentially dangerous heart rhythm in the ventricles. If the drugs aren't working or cause troubling side effects, doctors can turn to catheter ablation. For this procedure, a doctor gently guides a thin, flexible tube into a large vein and threads it up to the heart. Special instruments deliver heat or extreme cold to destroy or ablate tiny spots of tissue in the atrium to squelch the abnormal electrical signals before they set off an episode of atrial fib. In the study, nearly 1 in 5 people received catheter ablation. Ablation techniques have evolved over the past 2 decades and improve every year, Dr. Sawyer points out. Advice for people with AFib. However, it's important to recognize that the most serious threat from AFib is the heightened risk of stroke. That's why most people with AFib should also take anti-clotting drugs, regardless of the other treatments they receive, including ablation. Most primary care providers aren't comfortable prescribing rhythm control medication, said Dr. Sawyer. If you're diagnosed with AFib, it's worth consulting a cardiologist to make sure you're getting optimal treatment to minimize your symptoms, any drug side effects, and your risk of stroke. A side article is entitled AFib, Rhythm versus Rate Control. Given recent progress in AFib therapy, experts decided it was time to compare the 2 main treatment strategies for the condition. Their findings appear in the August 29, 2020 issue of the New England Journal of Medicine. WHO, 2,789 people from 135 medical centers in 11 European countries. Their average age was 70, and all had been diagnosed with AFib in the past year. What? Half the participants received rhythm control therapy, which included antiarrhythmic drugs like flecainide, which is also called Tambacor, and amiodarone, or Pacerone, or an ablation procedure. The other half received standard care, which included medications like beta blockers to slow the heart rate. Participants were followed a median of 5 years. The 3 serious outcomes, hospitalization, stroke, or death, occurred in 316 of those receiving usual care, but in just 249 of those who received early rhythm control therapy. Now here's a different article from the Harvard Heart Letter of January 2021, and it's entitled A Different Type of Heart Attack. Spontaneous coronary artery dissection is an under-recognized but important cause of heart attack, especially in younger women. Most heart attacks happen when a blood clot blocks an artery feeding the heart, but a small percentage result from a tear in the inner wall of one of the heart's arteries. The resulting flap or swelling inside the artery wall obstructs normal blood flow. Known as a spontaneous coronary artery dissection, or SCAD, S-C-A-D, the condition strikes both sexes, but is more common in women. In women who are under 50, SCAD is the most common reason for acute coronary syndrome. This medical emergency refers to inadequate blood flow to the heart. It includes both heart attacks and unstable angina, sudden chest pain that occurs at rest. SCAD accounts for at least 4% of all cases of acute coronary syndrome, but that figure is probably an underestimate, says Dr. Melissa Wood, co-director of the Corrigan Women's Heart Health Program at Harvard-affiliated Massachusetts General Hospital. In recent years, expanded awareness of heart disease in women has increased recognition of SCAD, which was considered quite rare just a decade ago. Improved diagnostic tools have also helped, she adds. For example, the blood tests to diagnose heart attacks that detect troponin, a substance released by damaged heart muscle, are now more sensitive. Women's hearts are smaller than men's and may therefore release small amounts of troponin, during a heart attack. Widespread use of high sensitivity troponin tests mean that women with heart attack symptoms are more likely to be diagnosed with a possible heart attack and referred for more extensive testing, Dr. Wood explains. As a result, more women are receiving coronary angiography, a special X-ray of the heart that uses dye to show areas of narrowing in the arteries supplying the heart. Because people with SCAD often have curly, corkscrew-like blood vessels, this test demands extra skill on the part of the doctor performing the angiogram. These physicians may also use special tools that allow them to look at the blood vessel from the inside out, says Dr. Wood. Other testing may include non-invasive imaging tests like CT scans and echocardiograms. An accurate diagnosis is vital because the treatment for the more common cause of acute coronary syndrome is heparin, an injectable drug that prevents blood clots. But heparin, which also increases bleeding, can make SCAD worse. People with SCAD may be treated with medications to relieve angina and lessen the heart's workload depending on their symptoms. Tears in the artery wall usually heal within 6 weeks, and any blood trapped inside the wall is gradually reabsorbed. Who is at risk? The typical SCAD patient is a middle-aged, healthy woman who doesn't seem to be a likely candidate for a heart attack. That is, she has few or none of the classic risk factors for plaque buildup in the arteries, such as diabetes, high cholesterol, or high blood pressure. About a third of SCAD cases in women occur during or soon after pregnancy, probably because blood vessels tend to soften and become more fragile during those times. The exact cause of SCAD isn't entirely clear, but there's a strong link between SCAD and fibromuscular dysplasia, or FMD, a rare condition marked by narrowing and enlargement of medium-sized arteries throughout the body, especially those leading to the kidneys, the neck, and the head. About 70 to 80% of people diagnosed with SCAD have some sort of vascular abnormality in the blood vessels outside the heart, Dr. Wood says. Most have FMD, but some have a rare genetic condition that affects connective tissue. At least a third of people with SCAD have a history of depression or anxiety, and two-thirds recall severe physical or emotional stress before their artery dissection. For example, they may have experienced a death in the family, a job loss, a spouse's extramarital affair, a car accident, or a child's serious illness. We know that stress contributes to all types of heart disease, which is why it's so important for people to manage stress as much as possible, says Dr. Wood. An attached note on this article is called SCAD Symptoms. The symptoms of a spontaneous coronary artery dissection are identical to those of classic heart attack and include chest pain or discomfort, pain in the arms, shoulders, neck, or jaw, shortness of breath, sweating, unusual extreme fatigue, nausea, and dizziness. Now we're going to return to research we're watching in the Harvard Heart Letter of January 2021. And the next article is entitled Googling Chest Pain During the COVID-19 Pandemic. Google searches for chest pain spiked in March and April of 2020 during the initial sharp rise in COVID-19 infections, according to a new study. The findings suggest that people were attempting to self-diagnose heart attacks and may explain why fewer people sought treatment for heart attacks in hospitals during the pandemic. The study relied on Google Trends, a tool that monitors search term queries over time. The authors looked at searches for chest pain, as well as five control terms, toothache, abdominal pain, knee pain, heart attack, and stroke from January 2017 through May 2020. Searches for chest pain, a common symptom of heart attack, but not COVID-19, spiked in states with high rates of COVID-19 infection, New York, New Jersey, and Illinois, while searches for other terms stayed steady. Fear of contracting the virus may have led people to self-triage instead of going to the hospital, says the authors, whose study was published online September 30, 2020, by the American Heart Journal. As they note, the odds of dying of COVID-19 are around 1%, but as many as half of people who do not receive treatment for a heart attack will die within a month. Artificially sweetened drinks, no heart health advantage? Think you're doing a heart a favor by drinking diet instead of regular soda? That may be wishful thinking, according to a research letter published November 30, 2020, in the Journal of the American College of Cardiology. Researchers studied nearly 105,000 people who filled out three 24-hour dietary recall surveys every 6 months. During a 10-year follow-up, researchers tracked the participants' cardiovascular health. Compared with people who drank neither sugary drinks nor artificially sweetened beverages, those who drank higher amounts of either type of beverage had a higher risk of having a heart attack, stroke, or other serious cardiovascular problem. High intake wasn't even that high. For both sugared and artificially sweetened drinks, the medium intake per day was around 6 ounces, or about a half a can of soda. Although researchers accounted for many confounding factors, like smoking, diabetes, and family history of heart disease, the findings can't prove a causal link between either beverage type and heart disease, but they cast doubt on the notion that sugar substitutes are safer for the heart than regular sugar. Now I'm going to turn to the Harvard Health Letter of January 2021. And I'm going to start with the Ask the Doctor section by Dr. Anthony Komaroff, MD. The first question is, what are the long-lasting effects of COVID-19? Question: I read that the death rate from COVID-19 is going down, but that people who recover from the infection can remain sick for a long time. Is that true? Answer: it is true. We don't yet know how big the problem is. COVID-19 has been with us for only a year, and there hasn't been enough time to know the long-term effects. When people first started getting sick with COVID, doctors thought that it affected primarily the lungs. Unfortunately, we quickly learned that it can also affect the heart, the kidneys, the brain, and other organs. This surprised many of us. In late February 2020, a previously healthy 30-year-old man I knew told me he had been running fevers, had experienced a seizure, and was worried he might have COVID. I reassured him, but I was wrong, and the patient was right. Within the next 4 weeks, doctors around the world were reporting various brain conditions in people with COVID. Some previously healthy people who survived COVID have been left with evidence of injury to the heart and kidneys. It's too soon to know whether the damage is permanent and whether it will affect their level of function. There are also people who have survived COVID and have no evidence of injury to the heart, kidneys, or brain, but who nevertheless have not returned to full health. They still have fatigue, body aches, shortness of breath, difficulty concentrating, inability to exercise, headache, and trouble sleeping. Some studies find that more than 50% of people who recovered from COVID remain hobbled by these symptoms 3 months later. They can't return to work. They can't fulfill their responsibilities at home. They are being called long haulers, H-A-U-L-E-R-S. Such lingering symptoms have been reported following recovery from a number of other infectious diseases like mononucleosis, Lyme disease, and SARS. So it's not surprising that this illness, which is similar to the illness called myalgic encephalomyelitis or chronic fatigue syndrome, develops following COVID. In other words, while fewer people who get COVID are dying, not all of them are recovering. We don't know how many people remain hobbled long term, but it's plausible that tens of thousands in the United States may never be the same again. The first reported cases of COVID in the United States and South Korea occurred on the same day. South Korea implemented containment strategies that were developed by the U.S. CDC. The United States did not. Since then, as of the time I write this, the United States has had 50 times more deaths per capita from COVID than South Korea. We could, therefore, have 50 times more long haulers, too. And the U.S. economy has shrunk while South Korea's has grown. Bad mistakes rarely lead to only temporary damage. Well, it looks like we've run out of time for today's episode of Health Issues. Be sure to listen next time. I hope you enjoyed it. I'm Dr. Scott Youngkin, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Health Issues is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. That's ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. That number again is 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service. I sure hope you enjoyed it.